Have you ever had the experience where you've had this big why question and you feel like you struggle with it and you struggle with it and there's maybe some glimmer of some idea of the why, but then it occurs to you that when it becomes clear, the answer is another question. We've had that illustrated here in front of you, behind me, this Advent season. As perhaps you've noticed, this banner was veiled intentionally, and each Sunday it's become a little clearer what's behind the veil. Mary got ahead of us a little bit last Sunday when she lifted the veil. I thought there's a whole sermon in that, but I'm not going to preach that sermon. I'll let you preach it. Thank you, Mary. We have lived with questions. This question, how will we know, is, I'm sure, a question that the people of God have lived with for all time. I recall a time in my life when it really bothered me that I had not figured out the answer to the big questions of life. After all, I grew up in a home where often Sunday morning and throughout the week the radio was on. Yeah, we know TV, but a radio. And often on weekday mornings and on Sunday mornings, there were these radio preachers. They had the answers. And they were convincing with their voices and their tone and their sense of assurance. And I thought, if I could just be that clear in my mind, to have the answers to life's big questions. And I thought that's certainly what mature faith is all about, isn't it? To have answers. To really know. I felt so inadequate for having these questions and didn't quite know where to go to ask them. Because everyone I was hearing had so much assurance of these questions. So I listened well. And I came to a point in my teen years where I thought I had a lot of things figured out. Makes me rather cringe now to think back on those years. However, then Heston College and then later life experiences and seminary, I began to learn how few answers I had, even though I may have had a lot more knowledge than I did when I was 16. And I came to realize that perhaps having all the answers wasn't what it was all about, but was rather perhaps not a good thing, all that certainty. Because I think that all that certainty combined with the kind of voice and the tone and the assurance can lead us into what can become a toxic faith, a toxic religion. Christian ethicist David Gushee, who was at Eastern Mennonite Seminary a few years ago, is pretty well renowned in Christian circles, particularly in more evangelical circles, wrote a book recently that offended many evangelicals and other Christians by the title, because the title was quite provocative. The title is, read it so I get it right, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. Yeah. In the book, he argues that what happened on January 6, 2021, when so many stormed the Capitol building, and you see signs about Jesus, and they were doing this in the name of Jesus, he says was entirely predictable, as much as it surprised so many of us. Because there is a growing movement in the Christian community of those who are fed up with democracy. It hasn't given them what they thought they wanted. And they're ready for a kind of Christian authoritarianism. And somehow, our former president, for some unknown reason, seems to be their answer. This is called Christian nationalism. Religion can be dangerous. More precisely, toxic religion is dangerous, not only to individual faith, but to the well-being of society, as David Gushee argues. And I think he's very convincing. Because there is a great temptation to always try to fit God in a box. And no box is big enough to fit God. Or God cannot be pigeonholed, thank God for that. I got to thinking about this more deeply this past week when I was walking one evening and had my earbuds in and was listening to a podcast called the Freedom Road Podcast out of Philadelphia. And the interviewer was interviewing a Palestinian professor, Christian, by the name of Dr. Mitri Rahib, founder and president of Dar al-Salima, Kalima University in Bethlehem. Just a word of context about what Dr. Rahib was talking about. He was describing some of the history of Israel-Palestine, particularly more recent history, where many years ago, Arabs and Jews that were living there were living in harmony and in peace with each other. And then European colonial powers, because they were afraid of what the Jews were going to do with in Europe and wanting a place for the Jews to go, thought it would be a good idea for the Jews to go back to their homeland. And to establish a country, the country of Israel, that led to the Arab Israeli war in 1948, now referred to by Palestinians as the Nakba, which in Arabic means catastrophe. The European powers were quoting, and many still do, the book of Joshua, because it's a book of conquest and colonization. This led to Palestinians being forced off their land in 1948 and into refugee camps. In 2015, Mary and I visited a couple of those camps where people, a whole generation of people now, have been born and have lived in these Palestinian refugee camps, not even knowing the freedom of their ancestors to farm the land, to be part of the land that they have been on for thousands of years. Which brings me to the quote from Dr. Rahib, which really caught my attention and the attention of the one conducting the interview. When she said, "Whoa, say that again." Here's the quote. "This is why in my language I tend to sound more secular, because I am in a context in which we have too much religion. People are getting suffocated from religion, and God is telling us, give me a break. I can't handle that much religion." Can you imagine God saying this? Anyway, I just gotten curious, and so I went to my Bible concordance and looked up the word religion. Any guesses on how many times it's found in the Bible, the word religion? 30? Down? Try 3. Once in the book of Acts, when Paul is talking about his former life as a Pharisee, and twice in the book of James, where the author defines religion as caring for the orphans and the widows in their distress. This is what religion is, folks. And I was thinking about, okay, think about religion and Jesus' experience. Seemed to find religion fairly toxic as well, to himself, to put it mildly. The first time he preached in the home synagogue, the entire congregation rose up in anger and tried to throw him over the cliff. The clergy had the same reaction to him whenever they saw him in action, particularly if it was on the Sabbath and healing or making someone whole, that they stood around in clumps trying to plot how they might get rid of him. And at one point, Jesus became so angry at the injustice that was happening in the temple with temple commerce and the place where the poor and the women should have been able to worship and could not because there was commerce taking place. Jesus got so angry that he set the animals free and overturned the furniture. So it seems that Jesus was never all that big on religion, to say it mildly. He seemed to perhaps view it as something people did when they were disappointed with God, when people could no longer stand surrounding themselves or surrendering themselves to the love that was not a formula, or a love that wouldn't give them sort of a textbook answer to their questions. So they invented religion to favor themselves, to have insiders and outsiders that give them the privileges and the answers. And they fell in love with that. And they worship that. And they spent their time making up systems for how others are to behave. And then governments found this as an excellent way to control people and to get people quiet and domesticated. And to get God domesticated, and spirituality gets private and personal. And faith becomes simply a matter of believing the right things so you can get to heaven when you die. And the oppressive powers love it because they can do and say and be whatever they want to be in the name of religion. Oh, sure, in the name of religion. And then people tell their pastor, stop, you're being political. It doesn't belong in the church. Thankfully, I haven't heard that here. And before long, religion has lost its power to transform or to be good news to the poor or to be good news to everyone for that matter. And it becomes a way to regulate and oppress others. And so Jesus wanted no part of that, it seemed, but I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit because there's another one that came before Jesus, and that's the one we read about, that Donella shared with us in the reading, that drew crowds in the wilderness. Oh yes, the wilderness, that wild place that drew crowds where there was beauty and dread in the wilderness, where you could go to find life, but you could just as easily die from disorientation, thirst, or being killed by a wild animal. There he is out there in that wildness, that wild man looking and acting like a wild man, learning to eat and like the delicacy of bugs dipped in honey. Try it sometime. And say, ooh, have you tried it? And this wild man is attracting the attention of the powers from on high who don't know what to make of him. And in your read, and then Danala's reading, did you notice the number of questions? He doesn't act, dress, or sound like any of those of their kind. And so they send a delegation out in the desert to find out who is this man. They are the professional appraisers, you might say, well equipped, or so they thought, to find out what John was up to, where he got the authority to act and to say the things that he was saying in the way that he was acting. So the first question, who are you? They ask him, and you can almost see them standing with their clipboards or with their iPads or whatever, with this form before them, with the boxes to check. Jew, yeah, okay. Orthodox, a Reform, fundamentalist, charismatic, Anabaptist. Whoops, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. None of the above. But what do you believe about the inerrancy of Scripture? Or the atonement, or transubstantiation? That's a nice word. None of the above. What do you believe about marriage? John, and the ordination of women. They want all the details, but John seems to be having none of it. Finally says, I'm not the Messiah. In verse 20 of John 1. And that's pretty interesting because that's not on the form. But John doesn't seem to care about their questions and their forms. Seems to be up to something that seems to be lost on his questioners. I'm not he, he says. And that's how the conversation starts, with a lot of questions, a lot of yes, no to the questions, mostly no. And if you've been married, know that any healthy conversation doesn't really go very far if one person is the questioner, the interrogator, and the other is simply saying no, 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 no. Well, then finally they say, okay, who are you? Are you Elijah? I'm not. Are you a prophet? No. Ah! This must have been so frustrating for those asking the questions. They have a religious identification form with boxes to fill, and John isn't cooperating with any of it. And finally, they put down the clipboard, the tablet, since they seem to finally be catching on that he's not cooperating with their interrogation. And so they simply ask, who are you? Let's have an answer for those who have sent us. We need to go back with some kind of an answer. And so far, we're not getting much. Finally, John says, I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the pathway for our Lord. The only claim he will make about himself, he's the voice. He is the megaphone, the microphone, the social media purveyor, the old-fashioned alarm clock. But he's not the main event. He's telling his audiences, he's sharing something that's to come. Something crucial about how he sees himself and about the one that he is proclaiming. And if they think John is hard to nail down, just wait for the one who's coming. The light, as John talks about this one, the light will not match any of their descriptions or fit into any of their boxes either. The light will not obey their rules. The light will simply be the light. And to be anything else would be not light, because you can't tame or domesticate light. You can only appreciate it and rely on it, like I do when I happen to be running or walking later in the evening these days when it gets light really early. And so I carry this little pen light in my pocket. And if I see someone approaching, I'll turn it on. And you see, it doesn't offer a lot of light, but enough so I'm seen and no one runs into me and I don't run into them. It'll help a little, but not all that much. But I can control that at my command with my cold fingers. I can turn it on and off. But the capital L light is like the sunrise or the sunset, which cannot be controlled, but appreciated, noticed. By refusing all the labels of a religious community, John turns out to be the right forerunner for the light coming into the world. Neither John nor Jesus will fit in anybody's pocket or Bible then or now. No system will contain them as much as the systems will try to nail them down or to eliminate them. John warns them, his visitors, with these words: among you stands one whom you do not know. Among you stands one whom you do not know. John tells that to those who are supposed to know, who purport to know so much about God. It must have been offensive to them. What John doesn't tell his visitors is that John's not so sure either who he is proclaiming and what he is waiting for, but that's the point. The point for John is that he knows that he does not know. And so he's open to the surprising light that is coming into the world. Is enough to trust God to open his eyes to see the light when the time comes. So we are given this passage from John's Gospel on the third Sunday of Advent, when one might think that we should be rehearsing the birth narrative. But no, we're reminding ourselves of what we know and what we don't know, and asking ourselves the question, how will we know? We still need John's testimony to the light. While we are waiting for the cry of a baby or for a little handle on the infinite and mysterious, we can use a reminder that none of us ever knows exactly what we are waiting for either. And so we ask, how will we know? We need not be ashamed or embarrassed to be asking these questions. We are in good company with John in the wilderness. It's a good thing, not a bad thing, to surrender ourselves to a love we cannot predict or control, to simply notice, as I did this week when I was out at Peace Valley and just about dusk and coming home up on the hill watching the sunset. I just stopped my car and watched. A man with a dog happened by and looked at me like, what's he doing? And I just pointed at the sunset. Wild, uncontrollable, the place of beauty. I have known PMC to be a place where it is perfectly acceptable to answer the question, how will we know, with the response, we don't know. And we don't have to have the answers, but believe the hard questions to be the ones that are as or more important. So we light candles. We know that night is part of any and every day, so we are not surprised by it, or put off by it, or fight it. And to accept the night as much as we accept the sunrise, sunrise, sunset, night, day, night, day. There is so much we cannot know about God, and there remains a mystery. But whom we see is the face of Jesus, the one who is described as the light by John, the one he points to. We too have a voice. So in the face of our unknowing, there are things we do know. That when and where we see injustice, we call it out and point to the light. That when we see hate, even and especially when it is veiled in religious or even language of the Bible, we speak up and we speak out because we are people of light. And where we see love and where we see justice and peacemaking, we rejoice and shed even more light on it. That's why a number of us are attending this week one of over 35 gatherings around the U.S. and Canada on Tuesday to visit our congressional leaders, Canadian leaders, to invite them to consider a ceasefire in Gaza, an immediate ceasefire, believing that we have a light to shine, a small light, a Mennonite light, a light that's important. And if you cannot go, there's a table in the fellowship hall where there are slips of papers for you to sign your name. Those slips of papers will be made into a paper chain that will be taken on Tuesday as your witness from those behind those of us who are going of your solidarity and your witness to the light. So this morning, as Ron introduced in the beginning, you have slips of paper found on the end of your bench. I invite you simply to, if you have a question you're living with, a question that has guided your faith in the past or that you're currently sitting with, you simply jot it on the slip of paper and during our offering time to bring it to the front. It's a symbol of your willingness to continue to ask and to sit with the questions and to bring it as an offering of your solidarity with those who are asking, continuing to ask questions and to point to the light. So we'll take a few moments of silence for you to write, and then when you're ready to simply bring your offerings of your slips of paper, your monetary offerings, and any offerings you have for fish as your way of speaking to the light